We need not recite the litany of world woes under which we suffer and the rest of the world suffers. For some of you, the question, why is sexism an important issue, an important concern, may seem absurd, but for others, in fact, it may be a significant question. Some, in fact, might suggest that an important attention paid to this issue is simply a further refinement of an overindulgent, selfish, and individualistic culture, already too comfortable, already too much concerned with its own inner relationships. Or others would say that surely it is at least only a minor issue that we probably bother too much about, especially in the church, which should be particularly concerned with perhaps other issues. To reflect on then the importance of sexism in the church, we have this evening Carol Nolte, Steve Ganskow-Wold, Judy Tice, and Joanne Hult, who will introduce themselves briefly and then make a few very short comments to help open our conversation this evening. After they have made their introductory remarks, we open the discussion to you, not only your questions, we hope, but also a genuine conversation among us. We'll proceed then until about 10 o'clock or so, and then take a brief recess, and those of you who wish to continue then may continue following that. Carol Nolte will open with comments this evening.
I'm Carol Nolte. I'm currently a student at a Luther Seminary in St. Paul. I have finished my first year and am going back for my middler year. I have, this is my second career. I've been an English teacher for 17 years, and so I'm one of those older students there. Why is it important to be concerned about sexism, specifically at the seminary, is what I would like to say something about, and I think we have a two-minute time limit, so I'll try and say just a few brief things. First of all, I think that it's important for me and for other women to be in the seminary and to be involved in seminary education because they are interested in theological studies and because they are capable in those areas. And they want, and I want, to put those skills to good use in the professional ministry. And up till this point, I think the church has ignored, simply ignored half of its resources in that field. And it's about time that they paid attention to many people who are interested there. Secondly, I think that there is something special that women will bring to the ministry, and I would say that women will bring a new dimension to ministry, and I don't mean by that just new darts in the vestments. I think that it's true that there are rational women and non-rational men, but I think that our society has tended to emphasize the role for pastors as being very rational and philosophical and speculative in terms of its training. And I think that with women in the seminary and studying theology, that there will be a new emphasis upon the intuitive, upon experience-oriented things, upon a more personal and a more practical theology. At least I would hope so, and I find that those emphases are already emerging. And as I attend classes and ask questions and question procedures and so forth, and I think that with us there, it will not only free women to study theology in the way that their skills and their way of seeing things is. But it will free men to step out of the rational approach as the only way and allow other models for ministry to develop. And I think that's really important. And I guess I just would close with a statement about the need, I think, for not only for women to be studying at the seminary, but the need to have some female teachers at the seminary. Because to this point, all the models are male, all the views are male views, all the answers are male answers. And I think that there really are some significant different ways of looking at things, and those kinds of approaches are coming. And I think that's really refreshing.
Steve, are you?
I'm Steve Ganskow-Wold. I hail from the large metropolis of Bison, South Dakota, the northwest part of South Dakota. I carry a common and an uncommon tag in relationship to the church. My common tag is that I'm an ordained pastor in the American Lutheran Church, and my uncommon tag is that I'm also a pastor's husband, which is a somewhat uncommon tag to carry these days. And so when Phil asked me to be on this panel, by the way, this is Cindy. She's also a pastor and is also the woman to whom I'm related by marriage. When he asked me to be on the panel, I felt somewhat honored. And also, I accepted happily because it's easy sometimes when we talk about sexism, generally and in relationship to the church, to think that it's strictly a women's issue, and if you talk about seeing women and it's easy to classify them as women's libbers or something like that and pass them off as being in that category. But the issue of sexism in the church is important both for women and men, and I speak specifically as a male, and I think it's important from our point of view because when we talk about the church, we're talking about a community. We're talking about a community of people, male and female, both created in the image of God and both redeemed by God in the person of Jesus Christ. And so as males and females, we have something both to learn from each other and to gain from each other as we share our gifts within that community. And so it's important, I think, at least from my point of view, and I think the biblical witness will support this view, is that when we talk about the gifts of each of us, male or female, we can't begin to limit it because of the genitalia that we were born with. Just to limit my participation as a pastor because I'm male is in some way, I think, denying the creative and redemptive, the continuing creative and redemptive activity of God in the world. And so when I think about it, I guess the main emphasis is in terms of God's gifts to us. And to limit them just because of our sex, be it male or female, is in some way, I think, denying the fact that God has created each of us in His image. And so one of the things that we hear a lot in our parish, we serve two parishes together as co-pastors, is that, well, it's going to take a while to get used to women. Well, we've been there a year now, and they're still saying that. And so the question I always raise is, how long is it going to take? Is it going to take? And not only in terms of the ministry of women as ordained clergy, but in all aspects of the life of the church. And so I think the time is now, and I think it's an important issue to be concerned about in the life of our church.
Thanks. Judy?
Oh, I'm Nick. Okay. I'm Judy Tice. I'm from Chicago, Illinois. I'm a music teacher in the Chicago Public Schools. And I also happen to be serving currently as the president of an organization called the Lutheran Women's Caucus, which is an intersynodical organization of women, which is dedicated to a lot of concerns which will probably be coming up as the discussion goes on. So I won't go very far into that right now. I'm going to be a little bit more general in my statement than Carol and Steve have been.
Could you speak up a little louder?
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. If one attempts to rate all the isms which plague our world today, say on a scale of 1 to 10, sexism may not always score as high as racism, ageism, imperialism, or some of the others. But there's little doubt whether or not sexism belongs in the top several isms, which need to bear the guilt of oppression worked on one or more segments of society, both here in our country and globally. In my opinion, any ism which prevents some portion of God's creation or someone of God's children from living up to the full potential intended by that creation, we have a serious problem. The question of whether or not sexism needs discussion is not even a question worth asking. Simply, sexism causes pain. Sexism divides human beings. Sexism explicitly or implicitly excludes much more than half the human race from developing into the whole people that God intended. Whether or not people feel the pain caused by sexism or sense the pangs of exclusion does not mean the pain and the exclusion do not exist. We well-fed Americans do not go around feeling hungry the way starving people here and on the other side of the world feel. But we know from well-informed sources that the gargantuan problem of world hunger exists, and we do well to make an attempt to understand the causes and conditions of world hunger and to respond in active ways to the information, even though we can say, well, we're not hungry. In the area of racism, it is unthinkable to say in this day and age, I don't own a slave, or I don't actively participate in the oppression of the black majority in South Africa. Therefore, I'm off the hook on that one. Rather, we look at the racial attitudes of our society and the end results of racism, poverty, and discrimination, and do well to make corporate and individual attempts to root out these evils. By the same token, then, sexism does not touch everyone in the same way or oppress every man and woman to the same degree, but it is a strong force in the world, in our country, and in our church. And to stand on the questions, what has this to do with me, or what do these women want, is to be uninformed and insensitive to a pervasive evil which exists alongside the major evils of our time.
Thank you, Judy. Joanne?
I get 20 seconds from you.
Be my guest.
I'm Joanne Holt. I am single. I am a member of a church, and I am speaking from that viewpoint. I also am a professional woman teaching at the University of Maryland. My area is physical education and athletics. My specialty is history and philosophy of sport. With my pedigree given, we begin. I think the question of sexism in the church and my belief about its importance stems pretty much from my vesper last night, which dealt with abundant living and fullness of life. And as each of the members of the panel have made quite clear, to stereotype anyone which denies them access to using their gifts, abilities, talents, vocation, or avocation can be near sin and demonic. I think that I was born and placed under a pink blanket and I wore pink booties ought not to influence what I do or I do not do in the church. And I think the problem moves into a very critical area of decision making, of power, of leadership, and therefore whether I will or I shall not be denied leadership responsibilities just by virtue of my sex. And I think that is more the norm in the churches than it is not. Now I can be chairperson of the dinner and all of the picnics that will occur, and I certainly can be superintendent of the Sunday school. None of those happen to be my long suits. Instead, I would rather lecture. I would rather teach the adult class. I would rather have my personhood experienced in leadership roles of healing, perhaps, an administrator, none of which is really open to me by virtue of my sex. I think the basic problem also for all women, all girls, and therefore all boys, in the Sunday school, for example, is that there are no models, or there are few models, which help them to see the abundant life and fullness of life from all areas, going from education in the schools to the home and back to the church. And that it's the models that I wish for them, that they have an opportunity to know, that they may serve in all capacities, that they are God's children in all ways, and that their sex does not limit that which they can do. I think, therefore, for the common good of all of us, that we have to review what is happening in the church so that the church does not oppress, but instead step forth with a great deal of boldness in what they are willing for both sexes to do in the church. My final thought comes from Tennyson on what I think happens often in the church, in the thought processes, and that is that man for the head, woman for the heart, man to command, woman to obey, and all else confusion. I suggest that for our common good, that it's the totality and the wholeness of Jesus Christ in his male and in his female qualities that we need to look and examine, and therefore move into new kinds of lifestyles, new kinds of social experiences, and creative living within the church, perhaps through interest groups and not by any form of stereotyping.
Thank you. Well, now we open the conversation to you. Please don't feel compelled to direct your questions or comments to those who have spoken already. We hope that you feel free to converse too with other members of this gathering across the room.
A comment and then a question for Carol. Carol, you mentioned, like, I just finished my second year at the same. Carol and I are in the same block over there in St. Paul. It's interesting to note, in terms of the whole rational thing that men are supposed to be so about and good at, that they developed a whole entire program called Clinical Pastoral Education, in which either seminary students or graduates of seminary, people who are ordained, can enter into, by which they can get in touch with their whole emotional side. Mm-hmm. It says a lot about our seminary training, mm-hmm. that we have to, you know, parallel out of that structure with a whole other system to get people in touch. My other question for you, Carol, is I see the church both as a supportive, caring community and also this massive bureaucracy of confusion that Joanne alluded to, that, you know, when it comes time to move that politically, it almost seems impossible. How do you, as an individual, how do you deal with the powerlessness of that, even on the local
on
issue
the
of the seminary? Or, you know, on the greater picture, how do you deal with that powerlessness? What do you do with maybe some anger that comes from that?
Are you talking about my looking ahead to a parish, or are you talking about right?
Well, wherever.
I guess, it's such a Marge Roll and I were talking this afternoon. There are so many huge issues that you don't even know where to go, so you just sort of fight where it hits you right at the moment. I guess, I fought a couple of small battles at the SEM this last year. They had to do with worship services that were very exclusive. You hope for some understanding with male professors who fail to see any other way of approaching, say, an assignment, but that very philosophical, speculative approach. And so you end up going and asking questions and saying, well, you've abstracted the language, and where's your image, where are the images, and so forth. I guess I fight the battles as they come to me. And it's very hard to get organized to fight anything else. I'm too busy studying Greek. I don't know. I mean, it's such a huge question, Dobie. I don't think I could be very specific unless we hashed it out an hour or two.
There may be others who would like to comment on that particular question.
Just from the standpoint of knowledge here, I'd like to see how many people in the room that their parishes do not have a councilwoman.
Mm. A councilwoman?
At least one. I mean, possibly more, like we have four on our council, but I would just be interested if there's any church left that doesn't have women on their council.
But the question is, it not how many have 50% on the council, since more than 50% are women, and then the next one, how many single?
That was my question, Joanne. You can ask that.
No, you said how many had women on the council.
Just women. Yeah, no, I was just curious. It wasn't a...
I mean, you can always have a token female.
For the sake of...
Well, get that first, then.
No, that's what I didn't mean.
How many token females?
No, I wasn't arguing the fact that they are there or they aren't there or how many. I was just curious. curious, you know, as a overall group, if there's anybody that at least hasn't recognized the fact, as you said, at least to put a token woman or whatever you want to call her, but, you know, at least to have women on council.
What do you think are the implications of that, if I might interject a question?
Why
is it so significant?
About 20, I forget exactly when, no, it's not that long ago, 17 years ago, I was on the church council, and as we left the first meeting, one of the members walked up and said, "And you're sitting in for your husband who is?"
That was 17 years ago. You've come a long way.
I do not have a husband.
I know it.
That was general announcement.
So to answer your question, it was just a curiosity that I had. I just thought that came to me. I was just wondering.
Oh, I'm wondering if it isn't an important question to ask. What is the significance of the fact that there is not, say, 50% representation for a congregation?
In our particular congregation, we don't have 50% women because a lot of women were asked and they said, "Well, gee, last year I was ALCW president and I just can't, you know, I can't do it right now." And a lot of the women were already so busy and, you know, a lot of other things.
That's right. They're so busy with the busy work that they haven't got time.
You know, that aside, I'm just saying, you know, we did just have a council president who was a woman who went through a divorce right in the midst of being president. She was well supported. You know, so it doesn't, just because there's not 50%, I mean, I'm not arguing one way or the other necessarily, but just because there's not 50% doesn't necessarily mean the congregation is sexist.
The church I just moved from in Illinois, our president of the congregation was a woman. We had four women council members out of nine. That wasn't too bad.
It worked out all right.
I'm from a church in Chicago, and as long as 20 years ago, the women broke into the council. We had the first year was one, then we got it up to two, and I think finally three. But significantly enough, this last year, the nominating committee presented four women and four men for election. And would you believe all four men were elected?
Mm-hmm. I would believe it. Well, no question.
But I mean, that's kind of a reversion as, you know, I mean, we were really very progressive 20 years ago, and we're going to have one woman on that council, and then all of a sudden they're beginning to reject him again.
How many women voted that night?
Well, this wasn't necessarily women voting because it was a family night potluck to bring people out, so we had a large attendance at our congregational meeting.
I think it's helpful to mention these specific examples to some degree, but I think the danger here is that we'll resort to quoting statistics and gain little insight. I'm wondering if out of this again we can move the conversation just a bit further beyond citing our church records. Did you
okay. Somebody
go ahead, and then we'll.
Well, from the tone here. There seems to be a sexist tone here, too. I'm just wondering if there's a danger here. You know, there's election of four women and four men and four men one. Maybe the four men were better qualified than the four women. I don't know. You would know, maybe. But I think that there's a danger here of talking about getting into a quota system of some sort.
Okay.
And we're faced here really with an historical problem, a traditional problem, a cultural problem, a psychological problem, an emotional problem. There's so many factors to it which have to be dealt with, I think, in a way that's positive. And I don't think it's very positive to all of a sudden to say that 50% of the council should have blue eyes and 50% should have brown eyes because that's the way it should be. I think it's a bit, over the years as we open it up, I think we have been opening it up, and my congregation is an example of that. There is a process where we have more women on the council, and I think they're highly qualified people. We have some men on the council who are also highly qualified people, I think. And I wouldn't want to give up either one of them, either side, because of their sex.
How do you highly qualify for being a Christian?
Pardon?
How do you get highly qualified?
They're active in the church. They are highly qualified as members of the congregation.
Paul, you have a comment.
It's a question. I'd like to throw it to the panel and anybody else. What do you think has been the function of women's auxiliaries in the church? Has it been to create a separate but equal system of leadership for people along sex lines? What do you think can be the function of women's auxiliaries like AOCW, what's not in the future? Or do you think we should abolish the notion of a women's auxiliary and work towards more of a unified system of leadership in the church? And if anybody can speak from this screen, please do.
Well, okay, I think that in the past, the function of women's auxiliaries in the church has been chiefly to siphon off the energies of the women and keep them out of the hair of the men. There's been a great deal of that present in the past. Not entirely, but there has been that. And I think that is in some ways changing right now as to whether the function of the auxiliary in the future, I would like to see a more unified system of total participation in the church. I don't see any need for a group of talented people, male and female, to divide the labor that strictly along the line. For example, in our church council, it might get said that we need to have a congregational meeting to assess our plans and our goals for the future, for the coming year. This does not mean that women don't participate in the council exactly, but the first thing that gets said is, could we get the ladies to make a supper to meet around this kind of function? Well, why not have the men make the supper for a change? Just for a change. I mean, I think that the role model could be juggled a little bit. Some of the, you know, plaster shaking loose a little on that.
Steve wants to make a brief comment here, and then we'll move back.
One of the things in our parish is that the ALCW is the only ongoing educational aspect in the whole church in terms of adult education. And that, I think that's really been a positive, real positive aspect, and ongoing Bible study and things like that. And, you know, it'd be nice to have a men included in that, you know. And the other thing is that one of the problems has been that because women, the auxiliaries, have oftentimes been the sort of the workhorses in the church, I think, in terms of doing a lot of the work, that, you know, there's sort of the busy work or the maintenance work and the keeping things rolling, in a sense. The men have used that as a sense, well, let's have men on the council. Men have to be involved somehow because the women do everything else. And so I think that's been negative, you know. And so I'd like to, I think, to establish something that would be include both, I think, would be a real good step.
Question back here.
Just one comment about the original question about, you know, what the significance is of having women on the council. One side of that, anyway, is the fact that it shows that there is a movement to take sexism out of the church, and it's moving in the right direction. And I don't know how you can demean the importance of the auxiliary, like he said, that if there was the workhorse, and if you took the women out of those places, I think the church would virtually fall apart in many of the places.
Are you suggesting that the church could, in a sense, serve as a model for other institutions in society in this respect, then?
Sure. You know, if I think of back about people who go away from the church and then come back, like you see people at baptism with their kids, and then probably you see them when they're young and in Sunday school, and when they get to be teenagers, you lose them a lot of time. And when those people come back to the church during marriage of their offspring or whatever, I believe, I'm not sure about this, but I could see it in our church anyway, that most of the families that came back because of the woman in the family, not because of the man. And the women were the ones that brought the family back together into the church. to take away, you know, to put that down is really bad.
Thank you.
I don't quite understand what you're saying in terms of the women, that the women ought to be held in whatever position they are now in terms of what they do, because they are the ones that's keeping the church together, and we shouldn't demean them, but keep the men where they are in whatever their function is?
Not necessarily in that light where you, but to keep the women in their some of the roles that they have, I think are very important. If you took them away from some of those roles, you would have really go downhill.
But if they're so important, why don't we put the male in that role put the female in
I'm
the
not
other
arguing
role?
With that. That's very true, and that's very good.
Well, but how can it happen if you want to keep them in this role? I mean, you can't have your cake and eat it too.
All of them. I mean, there's some that can and some that can't.
My suggestion on, can I comment on the auxiliary? I think it was absolutely imperative and significant at the time that we had it, just as the suffrage groups were absolutely imperative to have them as separate groups in order to have anything. But now, as the women are at work, the same as the men, and that the afternoon ladies' aid, which is when they met, has already changed, and so that the women who are working, and certainly the professional women who are single, are not in the ladies' aid group, which is the auxiliary kinds of groups. I would much prefer seeing interest groups and those that are free in the afternoon, that they would meet, and so that there would be no sex lines in any part, any form of the church, from the very kindergarten actions to the actions of the highest council, and on to the synod and the presidents and all of the institutional structure of the church, strictly on an interest basis, ability, gifts that you want to give, as opposed to gifts that they want me to give in the church.
How do you start out on something like this? Anybody have any ideas?
You just start an interest. Start calling a couples club, a fellowship, start calling the Lutheran Brotherhood group and the Women's Ladies Aid a Thursday afternoon work time for the world.
Service organization. I don't mean to speak in a demeaning way about the tasks that are performed in the kitchen of the church or at the altar with the cloths and vestments and vessels and so on. These tasks are all very important, and women have always made very wonderful contributions in this area. But I don't see that they need to be kept in those particular kinds of tasks.
Comment here?
I have two questions. One, or a comment. It would seem that perhaps, you know, sexism has to be solved, or some of these problems, from the top down or from the high leadership level, which would be, you know, from administration, seminaries, and so on. Right? So my question would be, number one, is are women restricted from seminary, number one? And number two, what percentage, say, of seminarians now are women?
It depends on the seminary.
There's a lot of seminaries, but there's a composite statistic.
Luther Northwestern will have, I think, between 10 and 20% women next year. There is very obvious sexism there, just in terms, say, of housing. As a matter of fact, one of the more interesting fights broke out late in the spring, when women were suddenly threatening the space of the men on campus. Percentage of women live off campus than men, and so I mean, just there are little things like that. The housing available. The lack of women administrators, women teachers at the seminary level, women models.
Are women applicants refused admission, or
no? Well, I mean, women and men applicants are both refused, depending on their qualifications. But I think that the qualified women are being accepted into the seminary, but there are limitations.
Is there anyone else here who could provide just a brief,
the last statistic I saw, that 40% of all Protestant seminarians are female.
40.
Some seminaries 50-50.
The percentage of females teaching at those seminaries.
A lot of two.
Yeah. Maximum of 5% in any one denomination. And the Lutherans is
way down.
All Lutherans. Of course, it becomes pretty difficult when we still have one Lutheran body that will not only not permit them to be ordained, but will not permit the women to vote. And we still have about a third of the Missouri Lutheran congregations that don't even have a vote. So it would be pretty tough to have them in important positions. Even when you look at the Lutheran higher education, which a lot of us are supporting, it is completely top-heavy with males. And it seems to me that's one of the places one could start. A Holden Village is a place where one could start on an equalization. But it's really the local congregations that can set the role models for the future, which is where it's all at.
Comment here.
I suggest that in 1920s, we were in a rural congregation. And in those days, the farmers seemed to have time, so they could be elected as delegates to both district and national conventions. Came to 1930, and the farmers didn't have time, so the women were elected as delegates. A large proportion of the women were delegates to our national conventions and district conventions. I wonder how it is today. I don't know, because nowadays, you know, it's only one person from the congregation and so forth. I don't really know how it is in the at the conventions, district and national. I don't know what the proportion is of women delegates.
Is there someone here who could comment on that?
Very poor at the LCA convention. You
know. 150 to 700 and something in one of them.
About 20%,
20%. And in those days, we also had women on the councils. There's 1930s and 20s.
Did you really?
Yes.
They also work side by side in the field, which might have something to do with
it. And in our church in Seattle, where the men often are doing serving the breakfast and whatnot.
That's an interesting comment, because a group of bishops were at Lutheran Northwestern at one time during the year, and their report was a rather hopeful one for women in terms of rural congregations. That is, the rural parishes were more accepting of women in the ordained role, whereas the suburban churches were looking very well askance at that. Maybe it was too threatening. It wasn't enough of a fad yet, so they couldn't take a chance on it. But the rural parishes were willing to call women.
Margaret, are you wanting to make a comment here?
Well, I think it's important to remember that things are moving. Mm-hmm. And it takes a lot of patience, and we are impatient, and I think it's good to push and to confront in those areas where confrontation is the most effective way. Mm-hmm. I wanted to respond when Paul brought up the matter of auxiliaries. I think we have to remember that in 1973 and 4, the ALCW was moved into the DLMC. It was part of the Vision for Life and Mission in the congregation. And I think the goal to work for toward would be the total oneness, unity of purpose of men and women in the church. But in the meantime, it's just not possible as yet, because there are too many things that need to be accomplished. And in the meantime, women need a political identity in the church at large. The black members of the Lutheran Church are just now, of the American Lutheran Church, have just recently formed a coalition of black Lutherans, because they realized there was no way being just, you know, units in the congregation that they could effectively make political changes. Without a women's auxiliary, there would be no budgeted possibilities for women to get together at all. And that's one of the great handicaps for women who want to politicize in any way or affect change, is that they always have to come at their own expense to the Lutheran Women's Caucus, to anything else, unless they can hustle money, grants of some kind. because the structures do not provide that kind of money. So, and it's going to take at least 3 more years for a woman to be qualified to teach in one of our seminaries. Karen Bloomquist is entering graduate school in theology this fall, having served over 3 years as a parish pastor. The rule that you have to serve a certain number of years as a parish pastor effectively eliminates all Lutheran women from that, because they've only been able to do that since 1970, and there have been none qualified for a number of those years. So it's taking time. It will come. In the meantime, it would be possible to have women from other denominations at our seminaries, but of course they could never be tenured professors, and they serve on a limited status. Some things are happening, and I think the important thing is to try, if possible, to channel our anger and our impatience in constructive ways and get to the point where some or other we can move beyond consciousness raising and beyond the venting of feelings to deliberate and rational planning and just really get together. Now, that's difficult because, as I say, women have no opportunity to get together unless they come at their own expense. Men of the church have legitimate structured ways they can get together in committees and task forces and conferences to plan and to mobilize their forces. Women have no such opportunity unless groups like the ALPW begin to see that they can help effect some changes for women.
That's what I was going to ask. Are you suggesting that the ALCW could in fact serve as a kind of women's coalition?
The ALCW could effectively serve if all the women of the ALC, who are by constitution, whether they like it or not, members of the ALCW, would start raising their voices to the powers that be in the ALCW and saying, we don't like it the way it is and we'd like it to do some other things. But as long as the majority of women in the church are happy with the ALCW the way it is, nothing will change.
I'd like to try to just shift something, if I could, just for a moment. It seems like you women have been dominating this discussion with all of your problems. Men have some problems also. There are some traditional areas within the church that men don't dare touch either. Try to teach a primary kindergarten Sunday school class and see what the reactions are. And there are a number of other areas. Try to go into the kitchen sometimes and help clean the kitchen and rearrange the dishes and plates and so on. All of them. So there can be some problems in that area for men also. And I'd like to see us kind of get away from this idea tonight, just that the women are the only ones that have the problem. We have one too, and we need to change women's thinking also in some respects in some of these areas, to think that men are able to teach, say, a primary or pre-primary Sunday school class and work with those children.
Bet you there's not a single Sunday school superintendent in a congregation in this country who wouldn't welcome a man to teach little kids.
The superintendent might, but what about some of the reactions of some of the people in the congregation?
What's the difference between men teaching primary Sunday school and men teaching primary elementary school?
You and I may agree with that sort of thing, but there are a lot of people that don't.
You would suggest that these are significant problems and tensions for men in the church, then, are you?
That's what I'm trying to say.
It's interesting because one of the strongest reactions I get from people is when I go in and help dry dishes after we have potluck suppers. People are amazed. Some people just stand there and look, and I have more comments about that, and besides my name, than anything else.
Well, we get locked into these traditional roles, and that's...
No, you lock yourself into the traditional roles.
A comment up here, I think, in response to that.
Why is everybody trying to get ahead? Why can't we just love each other and understand each other's needs instead of trying to fight to get ahead?
I wonder if the questions and comments that have been raised so far, in fact, are exactly trying to elaborate on the very point you're suggesting here.
question.
I wanted to, I'll follow up on your comment. I had an interesting experience just a few months ago in the Minnesota Synod of the LCA. There's a task force on the wholeness of men and women that was developed. And a group of men and women met for a weekend, and it was the most loving, interesting experience that I've had for a long time. The core of my comment is that I think it's going to be require both men and women working together. I too am encouraged by some of the things that I see. You're asking about specifics. I sit with the Professional Leadership Commission of the LCA. About 5 years ago, we're looking at statistics, and then we're only dealing with maybe a small handful. We saw the projections for the future. I think from Luther Seminary, there were just a handful, two or three that graduated this year. But as you look at your class, Carol, and ensuing classes, it's the numbers are coming. It's interesting, from my perspective, it's a lay movement. Only as lay people, lay women, are interested in going to the seminary, do we have the problem, if you will. So it's stemming from lay people. The solution will be with lay people. I was struck by your comment. Where do you start? This task force on the wholeness of men and women decided that one of the first things they had to do was to make sure that they got proper people elected to various committees in the Senate. At Senate convention, the only way to do that is to get names. So one of the tasks of those of us who are on that task force was to make sure that we went to district conventions to propose names of people that could then go to synodical conventions, who could then go to your national conventions and raise these issues. I really see it as a lay movement, and that's where the positive force has been coming from historically, and will continue to come from that, and certainly enlightened synodical leadership. I'm not terribly encouraged with clergy. But I am somewhat encouraged by the synodical leadership, and the lay movement is beginning to happen. The solution will be political.
Could you explain again briefly how this task force was formulated? Yeah.
Well, I think it was formulated because the...
Who initiated it?
The bishop of the church, Bishop Chilstrom, President Chilstrom, at the urging of some lay people, decided that this was an important thing to do and just did it. It was interesting. He was new in the job. Maybe that's why he did it. He didn't have all of the hesitation that maybe one who was older and maybe more politically wise would have. He just did it.
Comment up here? Question?
I was just going to make a comment. Perhaps in the church, women are held back because God is seen as male. In translation, why is God seen as male and God has no sex?
I think it's our culture that's held us back.
Anyone care to pick up on that matter?
Yesterday, she's a lady.
Not a lady, a woman.
God is. He thought of his wife.
I think it's exclusive versus inclusive language. If one practices it, you can get rid of the exclusive male sexist language, but it takes practice. I was thinking about it. Somebody mentioned he, God, he. I was thinking, now how could you switch that around so you wouldn't necessarily get involved with the sex-dominated language, the exclusive language?
If you think of it like the shoe, it's supposed to think of it as
a
mother, too.
Sure.
Yeah.
Huh? What did Jesus say when he died? Father, father? He didn't say mother and father.
Jesus was a Jew.
Fair comment, I think. Some might raise the question whether or not the language is really that important, that these other matters we've been discussing are. Right? Further comment on that.
Can I have a question here?
Yeah.
What about when Paul wrote in, I think it was in Ephesians or something, women be subject to your husbands or something like that?
He also wrote slaves obey your masters. We don't have slavery today.
Try it.
but he said, be obedient unto your husband.
I don't have a husband. I don't have to. I'm free. Galatians 3 also says there's no male or female.
Is it helpful simply to trade off Bible verses?
We can throw me in so far as you can make it apply.
Is there a comment that perhaps can put that into perspective? Paul, are you
suggesting? I would just like to find that not everything that is biblical is gospel. Too often we make that confusion. And we have to look at the total message of the word within it and not just pick it out in isolation.
How, what difference would it make when now it's made quite a difference that so many women are working? And it has made quite a difference in the urban churches, I know.
Fellas, champion
of the day here. I have a question that I need help in dealing with. I think the issue of sexism in the church is an important issue, but I'm not so sure it's a battle of the sexes, and that's kind of the impression I've got so far tonight. I'm on a committee that places all students at the seminary in intern positions for a year. Part of the problems we've had in some of those situations placing the women are the women in the church that we're trying to place them in, especially in the middle age brackets, who have a tremendous amount of difficulty accepting women on the other side of the altar. Which gives me, as a proposed male future leadership in the church, I'm looking for handles on how to deal with that. I mean, I can model, you know, in the kitchen helping doing dishes, and I kind of like to do that anyway. But, you know, that's a whole other side. Now, I need some feedback is, does anybody else see that in terms of women accepting women in the church?
Yes.
You know, and where do we go from here? How does your male leadership address that?
They probably run scared. No, I think that's a very real thing, and it comes through not only in the church, it comes through politically and every place else. The years of background that people, women, or suddenly, not so suddenly, but it appears that it was suddenly, there are a lot of roles open that weren't open to, say, me when I was little and on up. And there are some real threats. It's very threatening, and therefore it's denounced the whole thing. I see it in lots of ways, and I guess I see it in conservative America there is really a force that's fighting back. I thought earlier on we used the term backlash.
Yeah, I really don't know.
But I think it's something you have to be sensitive to, but you can't let it overdo it.
Yeah, I want to get back to Margaret's position in terms of, you know, where do we get past the axe grinding and start diffusing? I mean, I want to find out what's threatening. Let's start diffusing some of that stuff. Margaret?
Well, Gordon Alford, the psychologist, has written extensively about the psychology of people who have been victimized for centuries or who've been held in secondary positions after the Civil War when the slaves were emancipated. Many of them refused to leave their masters. They preferred to be slaves rather than be free, because what else could they do? They didn't know how to behave, or how, there was no place for them. They hadn't been trained, equipped for leadership. And so the place of security, like people who come to this country from a country like Sweden, and we've known some and have chosen to go back because they've chose security rather than freedom, you know, and the risk of being free. And women are the same way. One of the greatest psychological dilemmas of women is that a large percentage of them suffer from agoraphobia when they're psychoanalyzed or they have problems. And that's the fear of getting out of the house, a fear of being on their own, a fear of taking trips by themselves, of making their own arrangements. And strangely enough, many women never realize what they can do until they're widowed. Many women never do a thing for themselves till they're widows, and all of a sudden they're taking tours and trips and everything, and a whole new life opens up for them. That's in a way disastrous. But it's going to take a long, long time before the women of the church stop feeling guilty when they step out of their assigned role. And it's going to take a long time
before they feel that they have the right to get behind that altar or behind the altar rail, or that they can afford to take communion from anyone secondary to a male. And that's something that's got to take that's going to take a long, long time. It's coming, but it's slow.
Cindy?
As a pastor and as an intern, that's something that I face. And I think it's precisely that, Marge, that women in that age bracket have the most to lose or feel the most threatened by the choice that I've made for my life. And how I've handled it, and how we have handled it, is to make absolutely certain that we value the gifts that they have given to the church during their entire life, and that we don't invalidate their gifts of making coffee and their service in the church, because that happened to be what was available to them during their lifetime. And I don't want to make choices for them. I only pray that they let me live out the choice that I have made for my life and that God has made for me. And we can support one another in that and uphold one another in that. And the church is served very well that way. And I think that's precisely the point of the ALCW, is not, do we wipe it out? Well, of course not, because that serves very well. But do we enlarge it and see that it serves all the women in our church? And so that's how we've had to handle it, is to make sure that no one feels invalidated because I've chosen a different way.
Does it get through that way?
Well, I mean, you're dealing with people.
Yeah, okay.
It's not going to be the first time, but you keep going back at it. And we haven't had any serious problems with that.
Just one final brief comment here, then we'll recess for a few minutes to stretch our bones.
I think that Dobie has really hit one of the fundamental difficulties, not only in the church, but in the outside world, which is also faced in terms of single women. And that is the threat that we offer. And I think it's probably the fault of the women's liberation movement that has caused the immediate, sudden fear that we have. I think that by our consciousness-raising efforts, we had forgotten the fact that an awful lot of women are secure in the home, and further, that were they very secure, they might still want the home. And that in the process of our speeded up way of getting liberation, I had forgotten that many, many women really are totally fulfilled by their home lives and by their family lives, and that by making them feel that they were not fulfilled, they therefore became threatened. And it seems to me that it's a combination of the men who still see them as fulfilled as they help move them into any direction, and those of us who are impatient to deal with them on, I would like to do this, and it's fine with me that you do that, but I can serve you in this way just as your husband can. And I think that I miss that for at least 5 of my last 8 years of trying to deal with the freedom for women, that it just was not the time for it, and that now we have over-raised some consciousness that we have to deal with within the church. And I think it is a serious.
Let's take a break at this point, and then those of you who wish to remain may do so.